Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
There are already a large number of tasks for which AI agents are more competent than most workers.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
From Wandjeri Country, I'm Luke Siddham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap.
This news service will be called the Cable News Network and will program continually updated half-hour segments of national news, business news, sports and features 24 hours a day.
The pioneer of 24-hour rolling news, the founder of CNN, Ted Turner, has died at the age of 87. Today you're going to hear from one of the people who was there in the 80s, right at the beginning. The first Australian newsreader on CNN, Peter Ford. He's got some remarkable stories to share. Then, the other big story around today, the return of the Islamic State-linked families to Australia.
They're Australian citizens. If they've breached any criminal laws, that's what we have a criminal justice system for. But these kids and women are being used as a political football, and I would like to see our government stand up for the rights of our citizens.
That is the leader of the Greens. You'll hear her thoughts a little later. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap.
America is experiencing a totally new concept in television viewing. It's the cable news network, and it's available to cable homes throughout the United States. Never before has television captured the immediacy of news, the thorough, up-to-the-minute coverage that it does now. The Cable News Network, available 24 hours a day.
I worked till 7 o'clock, and when I got home, the news was over, so I missed television news completely, and I figured there were lots of people like me.
That was one of the reasons why almost 50 years ago, Ted Turner created the Cable News Network, CNN, ushering in this era of 24-hour news that exists still today. It took a while for it to be taken seriously. It was often mocked with the name Chicken Noodle News. They even had to sue the Reagan administration and rival networks to get access to the White House press pool. It was only when the network started covering politics and disasters and wars live across the day that they cemented their status as a major broadcaster. So back in the 80s, in the early days of CNN, our first guest was actually there.
That's our report. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Ford. Around the world every half hour, this is CNN Headline News.
Peter Ford was the first Australian to anchor on CNN, and he worked closely with Ted Turner. This morning, he joined Sally Sarah on Radio National Breakfast.
Peter, welcome to breakfast this morning.
G'day, Sally. Thank you.
Ted Turner was a media mogul, a philanthropist and an environmentalist. Who was the man that you first got to know back in the 1980s?
He was already famous by then. He had won the America's Cup in 1977, skippering the Courageous. So his nickname was Captain Courageous. He'd inherited a television station in Atlanta, a little tiny television station, and a billboard company when his father died. And Ted did two really radical, historic things. The first thing was he put that television station up on Satcom 1 and fed all the cable systems around the United States. And then he changed the entire landscape of news. News used to be a half-hour broadcast in the evenings. He changed everything by turning it into a 24-hour continuous delivery.
What was he like person to person?
He was great fun. I mean, he was, first of all, it was very exciting to be there. It was probably one of the most exciting times to be in television because everything was going to be new. Everything that CNN did was changing the rules. And Ted was leading it, and he was two guys. He was this visionary who had the courage and the foresight to break through barriers and change things. But he also liked to party. So you were dealing with two totally different personalities.
How do you describe how revolutionary the concept of CNN was in these early days?
Good question. Until July 1980, newscasts in America were about half an hour long, and CBS, NBC, and ABC, the three major networks, each had a news anchor who was known around the country. Walter Cronkite of CBS was the most trusted man in America. When Ted came along and said, we're going to change all that, they removed that almost cult aspect of a news anchor, the main news anchor, and they started putting up a different anchor every 40 minutes, every 30 minutes. And the second thing they did was they turned the newsroom into the set. So it was no longer a nice little chroma keyboard. It was everybody making the news was on the news.
What was the thinking behind that, do you know? Because a lot of stations do that now, including ABC has some of those backgrounds. Yep. What was the thinking?
It was first of all, economic. I mean, Ted inherited this company when his father committed suicide in 1965. And he had to change everything around to make it work because they were in debt. They had creditors coming to the door. He had to do deals for a product, and he was either going to buy old movies and put that on the air around the clock, or he was going to get something that was, as you know, less expensive, and that is live action broadcast. And for him, that was going to be the newsroom. And that's basically the reason why he started. But the first 3 years, we had a fundraising thermometer on a main pillar in the center of the newsroom. It looked like one of those steeple funds for the church steeple. And instead of dollars, we had cable subscribers. And for at least 3 years, it was in the red. I mean, he operated with a massive debt, but he always believed in what he was doing, and it paid off.
The coverage of the first Gulf War, how fundamental do you think that was to the way that CNN was perceived and its knock-on to the way that other news organisations covered the news?
Good question. It actually started before that. It started with the Falklands War when Margaret Thatcher decided to send warships down to the Falkland Islands off in Argentina. And that was the first time since Vietnam that people had seen anything like live coverage. In Vietnam, they flew the tape over, the film over from Saigon to Hawaii and put it on a satellite into the States. In CNN in 1981, people were watching it live. It was actually coming live off the bird into your living room. It was the first time anybody had seen that kind of action story in real time, and that changed everything. That changed the way people looked at CNN.
As an Australian working on CNN in those early days, what happened in terms of your accent? What needed to happen? What did Ted tell you?
Well, I just heard that clip. Yeah. And
it's pretty different.
It is. So I didn't realize that was happening. I got a voice coach later when I went to NBC because they wanted to hear a local accent. But back then, I thought it was Australian. But I think the first breakthrough was when the America's Cup was being run in 1983. And Ted had been a classic scholar at college. And so he used to like to walk down to the studio when you're on air. And in a break, he'd quote some classic to you, and you were supposed to come back with another quote. And I was finishing a broadcast just before the America's Cup, and I was on the set, and he walked past and he quoted Charles Dickens, "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times." And I quoted back Walt Whitman, who was a great Southern poet, as you know. And he said, come on upstairs, see the race. And I said, great. So upstairs usually meant there was a huge party on. When I went up to his office, it was just him, just the two of us. We were watching it on his giant screen television set. And saw the America's Cup, Alan Bond's team won, and I said, thank you for asking me up. By the way, why did you ask me? He said, I wanted an Australian with me to see Dennis Connor getting beaten.
Well, yes, indeed. That's a very honourable role. Peter, it's been great to talk to you this morning, and thank you so much for your recollections of Ted Turner and looking back as well on the changes that were ushered in with CNN. Nice to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ellie. It's been fun.
Peter Ford there, the first Australian to anchor on CNN. Now, before we move on, let me give you a sense of the tributes that have been coming in for Ted Turner. One from US President Donald Trump, who's called him one of the all-time greats and also a friend. And another person who's called him a friend, this one might be surprising, Rupert Murdoch. He followed in CNN's footsteps with Fox News, and this morning he's called Ted Turner a trailblazer and a friend. Now, we also heard from media reporter and ex-CNN contributor Claire Atkinson about why Rupert Murdoch's statement has come as a bit of a surprise.
They were very competitive. Obviously, Ted got there first when it came to cable. Rupert came soon after with Fox News. They had a very contentious public battle. They called each other names. Rupert put Ted Turner's face on a front page newspaper asking the question, is he nuts? Ted Turner famously said he wanted to fight Rupert Murdoch. It was very contentious. And so this statement from Rupert calling Ted Turner a trailblazer, a true American and a friend, is quite a surprise to see that perhaps they settled their differences.
Media reporter and ex-CNN contributor Claire Atkinson there. Fascinating, eh? That is the life of Ted Turner. Well, the other big story around today is the plight of the 13 Australians with ties to former Islamic State fighters that are now due to arrive in Australia today. They've spent years stranded in Syria's Al-Roj detention camp. The federal government says it has plans to manage and monitor this group of 4 women and 9 children, but it also says it will not be providing any assistance to the cohort, and they can expect to face the full force of the law when they arrive in Australia. So what does that mean? Australian Federal Police Commissioner Chrissy Barrett outlined plans for their return.
Some individuals will be arrested and charged. Some will face continued investigations when they arrive in Australia. And children who return in the cohort will be asked to undergo community integration programs, therapeutic support, and countering violent extremism programs.
And that's the Australian Federal Police Commissioner Chrissy Barrett there. Well, Peter Lowe was a director of countering violent extremism in the New South Wales Department of Justice. She's now with Phronesis Consulting and Training, and she joined Sally on breakfast this morning to walk us through what could happen today.
The government has come out and said, the AFP have said that a number of them will be charged. What that looks like, we don't yet know. Does that mean they'll be charged on arrival or charged at a later date? And that they will obviously be subject to further investigation, some of them, further monitoring, and I imagine a lot of support for the children as well.
The Australian Federal Police say some members of the group will be arrested and charged when they arrive in Australia. What do we know about the kind of charges they're expected to face?
I think some of the charges will relate to foreign incursion laws that we have already precedent for that. We've charged a previous returnee with foreign incursion, and that means staying in a prescribed area, so being in a particular area and staying in that area, which the Australian government made law that that was against our Commonwealth laws.
What about the children in this group? While some of the adults may be facing possible charges, as someone who's worked in encountering violent extremism, what needs to happen with these kids with the kind of support but also some of those de-radicalisation measures if necessary?
Yeah, I think if necessary is a good point here. We don't actually know with a lot of the children where they are in terms of their thinking. Any sort of health intervention in camps in Al-Roj has been almost none. And so really understanding physically how they are is going to be one of the first steps.
Peter, can the law compel children to undergo de-radicalisation?
It's not necessarily compelling them. As I understand it, they're going to be offered involvement in some of those programs. But if there are risks or there are certain welfare concerns for those children, then the same as we would capture any other welfare concerns under our child protection legislation, we can ensure that children get access to services that they need.
How important is psychological care for these kids?
It's really important. I think first and foremost is around safety. Those camps are not safe, either physically or emotionally. And I think that's one of the things that we need to ensure first up, there is safety for these children.
What do you think is the most important thing the government and involved agencies can do in the interest of national security when it comes to managing this group of women and children?
Look, I think one of the challenges ahead of us as a community is one of the things that is going to impact us all on safety is how well these families feel like they fit back into society. And I know that's challenging for some. if they've committed offences, then they should go before the court and charge the same as anyone else, and the court should hand down those consequences. And the community really should allow that to be a court process. These children had no choice. They have no agency in where they ended up. Some of them were born in these camps. And I think the one thing we can all do to ensure our safety is to make sure that those children feel as safe as possible within our communities and our schools and our societies. One of the things that we do know about successful reintegrations, both here and in other countries, is that the more we get the focus on safety and well-being, the safer all of the community is.
Peter Lowe there, a former Director of Countering Violent Extremism in the New South Wales Department of Justice. We're beginning to sound like a broken record because the federal government is just days away from handing down its budget. But the news today is that it's announced a series of fuel measures as the global oil crisis carries on. Here's a little bit of detail on what's been announced and also the response with our political correspondent, Tom Crowley.
Well, a little bit of criticism from Angus Taylor, who went out first with his fuel plan. The government's brought the minimum stockholding obligation up a little bit, but not quite as much as the coalition had called for. They're also spending a fair bit of government money both to underwrite exports but build a government-owned national stockpile of, I think it's a billion litres of fuel. Angus Taylor critical of it being government-owned, although some in his front bench might kind of like that idea. And there's a lot of bipartisanship for government money being spent on fuel these days. The government's also giving fuel support to Fiji, $30 million, the first concrete commitment for the Pacific to do with fuel.
Tom Crowley there. Well, Pat Conroy is the Minister for the Pacific and he's currently in Fiji for that deal. He spoke to Sally early this morning about a major security pact that the Australian government is attempting to strike with the Pacific nation, and she asked him for details on the timeline.
How close are Australia and Fiji to agreeing to this new strategic pact in the Pacific?
Well, we're still finalising some details at an officials and ministers level, but yesterday's announcement by Prime Minister Rambuka, Foreign Minister Wong and myself that we have agreed to establish a Vavale Union is a very significant move. It's a significant elevation in our relationship between two countries, and it builds on the success we've had in the Pacific in reaching strategic agreements with other countries, whether it's the Fali-Pili Union with Tuvalu, the Nauru-Australia Treaty, or the alliance with Papua New Guinea. This is a government committed to making sure we're the partner of choice in the Pacific, because we've been very open that there is a constant and permanent state of contest in the region for influence.
The Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, says the bilateral treaty will have three pillars, security, economic and people. Focusing on the security pillar, will this be similar to the defence treaty we recently signed with Papua New Guinea?
I'm not going to go into the details at this stage, Sally. You'd understand why we're still negotiating them. But what I can say is the security element will be there. I made a number of announcements yesterday in that area. After climate change, the number one security threat to Fiji is transnational crime and in particular drug smuggling. And we've already provided significant assistance to Guardian class patrol boats, the $83 million Maritime Essential Services Centre, and I announced further advancements, initiatives around border management to track individuals and support their border controls. So transnational crime is a major challenge for the whole region, and we stand with the region and we stand with Fiji to stop drug smuggling.
Last year, you went to the top of a volcano to give an initial agreement for security and development pact between Australia and Vanuatu, but it hasn't been signed by leaders and discussions seem bogged down. What's wrong there?
Well, we're continuing to negotiate the Nakamal agreement with the government of Vanuatu. It was a privilege to go to Mount Yasar with Penny Wong and Richard Miles, which is the volcano on Tanna and one of the sort of most spiritually important sites in Vanuatu. We're continuing to iron out the final details. It's fair to say that there was some in the Vanuatu government that were worried about the potential impact of specific clauses, and we're working to explain those clauses and obviously showing flexibility in how the agreement is constructed so that everyone is comfortable with it and everyone understands that this is in the interests of both nations.
Do you think think that China has been deliberately trying to block Australia's agreement with Vanuatu?
Well, I'm not going to go into activity of other countries in specific instances, but we've been very clear that we do face a permanent contest in the region. Many countries, including China, are seeking to assert influence in the region. Our view, quite frankly, is that we intend to honour the communique from the 2022 Pacific Island Forum Leaders Summit, which said clearly that the Pacific should partner with other Pacific nations for their security. If there's gaps in their security, they should come to other Pacific nations to fill that first. We're a proud Pacific nation. We're a foundation member of the PIF. And we're working very hard to ensure that we're the partner of choice for the region. But other countries outside our region obviously have a strong desire to be involved. And our view is that's most appropriately expressed in development relationships with the region. But for security, that should be driven and provided by Pacific nations.
Pat Conroy there, the Minister for the Pacific. So that is one part of the government's approach to the global fuel crisis. The other that Tom was talking about was this $10 billion package for storage and resilience. That is what Sally put to the Greens leader, Senator Larissa Waters, when she joined the program this morning.
What's your response to the government's $10 billion package for fuel storage and resilience? Is this an important investment in your view?
Well, look, we'll take a look at the detail of that, Sally, but I'm still baffled that in a fuel crisis, the federal government hasn't taken the opportunity to make public transport free across the country. Our government was the first to back in this illegal war, and so it has an obligation, I think, to help people out during this fuel crisis, and it could be funding making public transport free for the duration of this fuel crisis to actually help people with the cost of living and also free up fuel supplies for those that desperately need it.
But is public transport not a state issue?
Well, traditionally it is, but the federal government has backed in this war and they should pay to help people who are feeling the pain of it.
I think the other key thing here is,
well, that's right. If you free up fuel in the cities, you can make it available in the regions and where they don't have public transport. Every little bit will help. But importantly, Sally, I think the worst lesson to learn from this fuel crisis is to back in more fossil fuels. I think it's really clear that we need energy independence, and the most reliable and cleanest and cheapest form of energy independence is renewable energy. The sun and the wind don't go through the Strait of Hormuz, do they? So that's where we should be investing to have that clean, affordable, reliable supply in future.
A group of 13 Australian women and children with family links to former Islamic State fighters are expected to arrive in Australia later today. The Federal Police say some of them will be arrested upon arrival. What's your view about what should happen to this cohort?
Look, I'm pleased that these kids and their mums are coming home. They're Australian citizens, their children and their families. And I think if they've breached any criminal laws, that's what we have a criminal justice system for. But these kids and women are being used as a political football. And I would like to see our government stand up for the rights of our citizens and help these folk reintegrate.
And that is the Greens leader, Senator Larissa Waters, discussing the Islamic State-linked families and, before that, the government's fuel plan. Well, thank you so much for listening to The Breakfast Wrap today. All of those interviews produced by the Radio National Breakfast team, presented by Sally Sara, and The Breakfast Wrap was produced by Ted O'Connor. Well, I'll leave you with a little bit of the late CNN founder Ted Turner, who's died overnight at the age of 87, and how he is being remembered as a pioneer of 24-hour rolling news.
Behind me, you can see our new cable news network headquarters. The building is designed to help us really do the job. Not just the job of compiling news and organizing it, but the job of getting it to you in seconds.
Ted Turner made a bet that people wanted to watch news on a 24-hour basis at a time when there was a morning bulletin and an evening bulletin, and he proved, you know, his business case was correct. People did want to tune in.